Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. In Oklahoma, only 22% of Oklahomans have an advanced directive. Because of this, Claire House is leading Tulsa Healthcare Decisions Day, a local effort to highlight the importance of advanced healthcare decision-making and encourage the public to take action by documenting their healthcare wishes and engaging in conversations with family and friends. This coming Thursday, April 16th, at both 10 a.m. and 6 p.m., Claire House invites the public to join Tulsa Healthcare Decisions Day virtually via Zoom. The program will feature Your Voice, Your Wishes, Your Advanced Directive, a video guide to the Oklahoma Advanced Directive for Healthcare, followed by a teaching session and question and answers with local experts. These sessions will be repeated in the coming weeks on April 23rd and 30th. And these events are free and open to the public. To learn more about them, you just need to register with Claire House at their website, www.clairehouse.org. My guests today will teach us about advanced directives. They are Kelly Scott, Executive Director of Claire House, and Dr. Jennifer Clark, who's a medical liaison for Claire House and a visiting assistant professor of healthcare delivery science at the Oxley College of Health Sciences at the University of Tulsa. As a result of Tulsa Healthcare Decisions Day, fewer families and healthcare providers will have to struggle with making difficult healthcare decisions in the absence of guidance from the patient themselves. Healthcare providers and facilities will be better equipped to honor patient wishes when the time comes to do so. And again, this has probably never been as important as it is right now during the coronavirus pandemic. Kelly Scott, Jennifer Clark, welcome to Medical Monday. Let's start by having one of you talk about what Healthcare Decisions Day is and then how it will play out here in Tulsa.
National Healthcare Decisions Day has been going on for quite a while, but Tulsa's never participated in it before. And it's a day to really focus on filling out and sharing advanced directives so that planning in advance for when you have a life-threatening illness and when people may have to make decisions for you. So the goal is to help make sure that people have thought about those plans and communicated them to their loved ones.
So if I understand correctly from national data, something like only 37% of adults or Americans have an advanced directive. And so there's a vast majority of us that don't have those. How long has Tulsa Healthcare Decisions Day been in the works? I mean, how long have you been thinking about this or planning it?
Claire House has embraced community education as a way to expand the mission that we do in our home every day. We try to take that intentional living and preparing for serious illness outside the doors of our home out into the community and educate our citizens about what they need to be thinking about when that time comes for them. And we have a wide variety of programs that we offer to that end. As we've gone out there and done teaching and hosted some of our programs, we get feedback very frequently that people don't understand the Oklahoma Advanced Directive form. They have filled one out, but they haven't shared it with anyone. They don't know really what it means. They're not sure exactly what choices they made because they did it so long ago. And we've just been hearing a lot of either a complete lack of doing the process or not really understanding or communicating it well to those that are going to be tasked with this responsibility. So we put together this program in response to that need and felt like the tagging on to the National Day would be a great way for us to get that word out there.
So Jennifer Clark, you are board certified in hospice and palliative care medicine and do a lot of this kind of work. What are some reasons people don't fill out advanced directives? Is it just fear or lack of education or kind of both?
It's a combination of both. In America particularly, we have a culture, a death-defying culture, if you will, meaning death and its conversations and the experience is not something that's a natural part of our day-to-day lives and community. And so as a result, people just don't talk about it. So, you know, kind of that piece of things. As end-of-life care has come to rise and the practices of hospice and palliative care over the last decade have really taken hold within the medical system, the conversations about end-of-life are growing. And as a result, people are beginning to think about this in a proactive way, and that comes out in advanced care planning. And so when people say, okay, I have had a loved one, or I have had the experience of having a loved one in a hospital setting and die, you know, kind of a death that they would never have wanted on machines, you know, facing a serious illness that wasn't planned for in a way that didn't really meld with their kind of ethos and the way that they lived their life. They've learned from that experience and say, I know that I can make a decision in advance. I can make my wishes known so that those people who are caring for me, whether it be my family members or the healthcare team that will be caring for me at the end of life, know what matters most to me. And that process needs education. And so we have a culture that doesn't want to talk about death. And as a result, we don't have these conversations. And so a lot of people, when they're ready for them, need to have some guidance and education on them so that when the time does come, it actually is meaningful. You know, one of the things that happens often is that people come in with an advance directive. They're not quite sure what the form has said. They've filled out these boxes. And when we actually go to talk to the family members about them, it's inconsistent. The other thing that advance directives help us with is actually identifying a person that will make the decisions on your behalf. And oftentimes people don't have the conversation about what their wishes are with the person that they've identified. And so, you know, this person that has been named that is bearing this responsibility of helping to bring to life the decisions that a person would want should they not be able to speak for themselves are often left with, I wish we had had this conversation. And so this effort will address both of those issues. One, making it okay to talk about death and that it's a normal part of human life and to plan for it appropriately.
So, Kelly, you mentioned that the Oklahoma forms, for example, are available on the web. So we can just pull these out. You don't need a lawyer for an advance directive, right? That's something we want to get out there.
Absolutely not. They are available online. You can print them. You can complete them if you can make sense of them. And that, I think, is a challenge. That's why a lot of people do it as part of their estate planning, is that they work with an attorney to do that. And that's helpful if your attorney is well-versed in the language of the advance directive. But it is, above all else, these are medical decisions. So the best place for this conversation to happen is probably with your primary healthcare provider, that you have this conversation with your doctor, with your PA, with your nurse practitioner, and you discuss all the options that are a part of this form. The state of Oklahoma has taken great pains to cover a variety of scenarios, but it takes some understanding of what that medical situation is and what your choices imply to actually capture the decisions that you want to reflect.
And Jennifer, you mentioned the importance of having someone available to make decisions if you're incapacitated. And I think we default often to a spouse or to a family member. Is there a most helpful way for listeners to think about that, who they would want to appoint to be what we might call a surrogate decision maker, mm-hmm. or the more fancy legal term, we have this durable power of attorney for healthcare? Is it best to go with a spouse or not necessarily?
The person that is your healthcare proxy or the surrogate or a durable power of attorney for medical decision making, when you think about assigning that person, you want to think about them as acting on your behalf, being able to set their own opinions aside and say, I'm here because my loved one, my friend, my spouse, my daughter, whoever it happens to be, cannot speak for themselves, but she or he and I have had a conversation that they have made it known what their wishes are. And in this context, I'm going to make decisions on their behalf. So sometimes that isn't your spouse. Sometimes that isn't a family member. Sometimes it's a colleague or a friend or a church member that you trust will be able to speak for you with your own words to make medical decisions when you can't do it for yourself.
And I guess that's why it's so important to have that conversation. At the very least, if there's nothing else I think you get out of Tulsa Healthcare Decisions Day, thinking about who you might want to make those decisions seems incredibly important, because if someone is called upon to make decisions and you haven't had that discussion, I think it's hard for people, as you were saying, to separate themselves and what they might want from what your actual wish is.
Exactly.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guests today are Kelly Scott, who's executive director of Clare House, and Dr. Jennifer Clark, who is a volunteer medical liaison with Clare House, also a visiting associate professor of community medicine at the Oxley College of Health Sciences here at TU. And we're talking about Tulsa Healthcare Decisions Day, which is going to take place April 16th in concordance with National Healthcare Decisions Day. Kelly, remind us a little bit about Clare House and your mission.
We are a home for terminally ill people who are in their last days or weeks of life who don't have enough caregiver support to remain in their own home. Those final days and weeks of life are really intense, related to the caregiver needs that that dying person has. And some people just don't have enough family, available family, families that are able to provide this kind of care, or friends that would step in and provide this care. And yet these people don't want to die in an institution. They don't want to go back to the hospital. They don't want to be in a long-term care facility. They would choose to be at home, as would a vast majority of Americans would prefer to die at home. It is a difficult time, and the physical strains are a part of that, as are the emotional and financial burdens that go along with caring for somebody at the end of life. And Clare House formed 17 years ago as a response to this caregiver need to provide the home and the 24/7 care that's not covered by anybody else. It's not paid for by Medicare or private insurance. The hospice Medicare benefit does not include housing and 24/7 care. And so there's a real gap, and people were not experiencing the kind of deaths that they would choose if they had more options, because we didn't have a home like this in our community. So we made one. We just created it from scratch with no real model to follow. And we opened back in 2003 in a little rented apartment. And the community has really embraced and supported this model of care. It's a freestanding, completely charity-based organization that will care for anyone of any age, of any diagnosis, in those last weeks of life. We work with any hospice program in town because we don't provide the medical case management. The hospice providers do. They're reimbursed by Medicare to do that. So they come into our home, provide that case management, and we're like an extension of the family. And it's a great collaboration between two very distinct services that are helping round out holistic care for people at the end of life.
I think you made an important distinction there, because I think those of us that know about Clare House may make the quick association that it is a hospice,
yes,
when in fact it's not. Really, it's really more sanctuary or extension of the home, as you elegantly put it. And so one of the things that I guess has surprised me, a couple of things. One is that I think for the first time ever since I've been involved in medical care, less than half of people are dying in the hospital, or than it used to be that most Americans died in hospital. That's no longer the case.
Well, I just read this article this morning from the Kaiser Foundation that was a new study that's come out looking at the place of death for people. And it was hospitals as the number one location of death. But just with this last study that I think came all the way through 2017, home is now the most common place of death, but that percentage of home deaths is 30.7% of people. So
we're not there yet.
But
it's a plurality. It's not
right.
Certainly not a majority.
Right. And the switch from hospice to home was by 2 or 3 percentage points. So it wasn't like we've made tremendous progress over the last years, but we can no longer say that hospitals are the primary place of death. Homes are.
So one of the things, there's been this profusion of, because of the hospice, the Medicare hospice benefit, it seems like there are many, many hospice organizations, both not-for-profits, some religiously affiliated, some not, but also for-profit hospices. And so as a doctor, I think you get deluged with different forms from hospices, even some, you know, bordering on fraud, where this was years ago in Chicago, I had a patient who had not elected hospice, and yet there was a hospice that had enrolled him, I think in a moment of vulnerability and confusion, and, you know, they were billing Medicare for this patient, and there are stories like that. So I guess, Jennifer, from your point of view, how does the hospice benefit play out, or what are some things that you think about from either a medical viewpoint or as a caregiver?
So to just differentiate, you know, sometimes there's a confusion about what hospice is in palliative medicine. And so, you know, kind of the combination of the practice is that hospice care is dedicated and designed for the last 6 months of life around the concept of the Medicare beneficiary, where palliative care takes the tenets of hospice and moves it much further upstream in the trajectory of illness. So you'll oftentimes see palliative care physicians and their teams made up of nurse practitioners and pharmacists and social workers and all sorts of, you know, kind of disciplines to round out an interdisciplinary team taking care of a patient who's suffering serious illness. You'll often see them way upstream in the hospital or in a subspecialty clinic, helping people really make complex medical decision making. And so when the time comes that someone's prognosis has reached those last 6 months of life, then we have to consider enrolling someone in hospice. Hospice is the most significant amount of care in our medical system in the U.S. that you can get at home. It supplies, you know, medications, all of your providers, you know, the interdisciplinary team that I talked about, any equipment that you would need. But as Kelly said, it doesn't cover that 24/7 care that really lays upon the family. The unfortunate thing is that in the U.S., because of the things we talked about with the death-defying culture and not having these conversations and making plans, oftentimes we only enter hospice in the last days, potentially hours of life. And so we don't get to take advantage of that period of time. So many people are enrolling much, much later, and they're often enrolling under a crisis. And that's what we're hoping that advanced care planning offers, is that we start talking about these decisions to take advantage of the amazing things that are in our healthcare system, such as hospice, in a much earlier setting so that we can avoid an unnecessary crisis and avoid what you were just talking about, which is inappropriate use or, you know, kind of preying on vulnerability. And so that's, you know, kind of one of the key tenets of why it's so important to do advanced care planning.
One thing I wanted to ask you both in regard to Healthcare Decisions Day and advanced directives is I sense from people that it's certainly hard to broach the subject, hard to talk about one's inevitable death. And so that's why we don't do it. And you mentioned it's a cultural phenomenon. I mean, I think there are definitely other cultures and other places where death is, you know, was a normal part of life. And even in America and, you know, previous centuries, it was, you know, people died at home, and it wasn't something that was foreign. Or when most Americans were rural or lived on farms, death, you know, of animals and things was a part of life. But we have this sense that we are filling out with a lawyer or not, we're filling out a legal document, and so it's intimidating. And as you mentioned, it's hard sometimes for people to understand. And so I think some people are afraid to actually sign or write out an advance directive because there's a sense it's irrevocable. And that really couldn't be further from the truth, right? So people, this is something I have to remind resident physicians, trainees, that if somebody makes a medical decision, it's perfectly okay to change their mind.
Right? Yeah. I you know, kind of one thing I want to say about, you know, kind of reframing that conversation. So one, we have no problem talking about doing our mammograms or our colonoscopies or all the other preventative screenings and measures that we have in medicine. Advanced care planning is a preventative measure. So, you know, kind of the conversation should start at the primary care level, where just like we check off the box when you hit certain ages with certain screenings, advanced care planning becomes one of those check boxes of, hey, have you really thought about this? So it normalizes that conversation. So I think, you know, kind of to address, you know, kind of that first part of things is that we really do need to normalize the conversation so that it is easier to have.
And where you don't want it to happen is in an ICU waiting room or an ER waiting room when you've had some significant crisis of a loved one and everyone's standing around saying, well, this is what I think mom would want, or no, that's not what I think mom would want. And it devolves into this huge family conflict because nobody really knows what mom wants because nobody asked her or she never really shared it with anyone. Or maybe she did fill out an advance directive, but it's locked in her safety deposit box somewhere and nobody has any idea where the key is or how to get to it. So that's what you don't want to happen. As far as how do you make that difficult conversation possible within your family, it is part of a conversation that should have a normal place in the rhythm of life, as Jennifer mentioned. It doesn't for a lot of families, so sometimes you have to find those opportunities. And one way that I think is really helpful is when there's been some sort of death or accident or situation that has some public attention. And there's a spotlight that's shown on it on the news with all kinds of stories that you might be reading on social media. And then to be able to say, to call a son or a parent and say, wow, did you hear about what happened to somebody? What if that happened to you, Mom? What would you want me to do? What am I supposed to do if I get that call from the hospital and they don't think you're going to survive and I'm called in to make those decisions for you? So to use that sort of distant scenario to help you talk about it on a personal level may be one place to start.
And then the issue about revocation. So an advance directive only applies when you can't speak for yourself. So should there come a time, just like every other screening, it needs to be updated on a year-to-year basis to kind of say, have my values changed? Have things changed? Has my medical condition changed? Has my, you know, kind of, and so, you know, kind of relooking at them on a year-to-year basis, whether it's at your birthday or, as one of our friends does at Thanksgiving with all of her family members, is updating it every single year and checking in. Has things changed? Has the conversations changed? Has, you know, kind of the value shifted? And that document, as easy it is to fill out, is as easy to kind of tear up. It just needs to be effectively communicated to those that are involved. So the healthcare proxies need to know, the people that you've named to make decisions on your behalf, your healthcare providers need to know. So revocation is just as easy as filling it out. But this form represents that you've had a conversation. So if you've decided to change that form, get rid of that form, then that conversation also needs to be had.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. And my guests today are Kelly Scott, who is Executive Director of Clare House, and Dr. Jennifer Clark, Volunteer Medical Liaison with Clare House, who's also a Visiting Associate Professor of Community Medicine here at TU. And we're talking about Tulsa Healthcare Decisions Day, which will take place on April 16th. And Kelly, I wanted to ask you where people are referred to Clare House from. Is it mostly hospitals, or is it just a matter of who's aware of Clare House in the community, or from anywhere?
It's all of those above. We do receive those referrals from everywhere, but predominantly at this point in time, they're coming from our hospice partners, the medical hospice partners, and our local hospitals. There was a time 10 years ago when the majority of the Clare House guests were admitted from home. That has changed over the last few years, and now the majority of our guests do come from local hospitals. Again, that speaks to what we perceive as a need to do more extensive conversation and planning. People are coming to us and staying shorter lengths of time, so our length of stay at Clare House has diminished significantly over the last several years. I would have hoped that as people got to know us better, as Clare House became more of a household word in our community, that our lengths of stay would go up, that people would be coming to us earlier. But for some reason, that's not happening in our community. We are getting referrals very late in people's conditions, and that sometimes they come to us and they're with us for less than 24 hours. It's not ideal. I mean, we have a lot of support to offer. And the more time that people have to spend in our home, be surrounded by all that loving care and support, receive all that attention and support from their medical hospice provider, hopefully that's going to help them achieve their goals of a peaceful death and whatever things they might have on their bucket list and what they want to work on from a legacy standpoint or reconciling relationships. There's a tremendous opportunity to spend those final days accomplishing some pretty meaningful, significant tasks that can help make that whole dying process a more meaningful part of the family story. It also helps those that go on to have a healthier grief experience because they know they have no regrets. They know they've done everything they could. They got accomplished everything that their loved one wanted with them. And to rob people of that time because the decisions are coming so late is tragic.
Jennifer, I want to ask how you became interested in pursuing hospice and palliative care as a specialty.
My primary training is in internal medicine and pediatrics, and so I was really interested in human development and ethics, particularly like how people make the decisions that they make. And when I entered into medical school and then ultimately residency, the concept of palliative care didn't actually exist. And I was fortunate enough, I trained at the Medical University of South Carolina. And during an ICU rotation, there was a nurse that was one of the leaders nationally that had identified and recommended that I look into this burgeoning field of palliative care that had born out of the hospice movement. And so was fortunate enough to be mentored by her and subsequently some of the kind of forefathers and foremothers of the palliative care movement in the United States. And so at that point, completed my training and then was fortunate enough to be in the first wave of people to become board certified in hospice and palliative medicine as board certification became available in 2008.
Yeah, so very recent medical field.
Yes.
Yeah. And Kelly, what about you? What was your career trajectory?
My first job out of nursing school was on an oncology unit with an attached autologous bone marrow transplant unit in Oklahoma City. And many, many, many of the people in that bone marrow transplant unit, the majority of them did not survive. I mean, I was 22 at the time, but I always gravitated towards the people that weren't getting better. That just felt to me like that was the space where I could have the most impact. And I migrated into hospice about 6 years into my nursing career and began doing that full time. So I was in Indiana at the time and doing home hospice. And loving that, and then came to Tulsa in 96 and did home hospice here, and then worked as a palliative nurse consultant in the hospital, and that led to seeing this need and beginning the project of Clare House. But it was always this sense that it's an incredibly amazing privilege to be invited into someone's life at that most intimate mm-hmm. time of their final days, and you know the deal. You know they're not going to get better. You know that they're probably going to die. But if you can make a difference in that and help them have a better experience and give them some great memories and help their survivors be at peace about that, it's just an amazing privileged place to be.
Well, Tulsa Healthcare Decisions Day is going to take place on April 16th. It's presented by Clare House, and if you are inclined to want to learn more, there's no obligation, but just free and open to the public, you want to learn more about what an advance directive is, what the Oklahoma rules are about advance directives, or possibly fill one out, or just learn what it might take to fill one out, then you can get this information from Clare House staffers and affiliates. I want to thank both of you for coming by. My guests today, Dr. Jennifer Clark and Kelly Scott, who is the executive director of Clare House. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting us.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann. Please stay safe and keep your distance.